You are listening to The Globalist, first broadcast on the 3rd of May 2022 on Monocle 24, The Globalist in association with UBS. Live from London, this is The Globalist. I am Markus Hippi. Coming up, we discuss reports from the US that suggest Russia will try to annex Ukraine's Luhansk and Donetsk regions later this month, and look at whether Moscow may formally declare war on Ukraine at next week's Victory Day celebrations. Then, with Sweden and Finland set to send their NATO membership applications soon, we hear how Russia may be getting ready to fight back. A bit later, we hear why the Pacific Islands suddenly find themselves in the center of a geopolitical tug-of-war between China and the United States. And the music journalist Jude Rogers talks about why pop music can have such an impact on our mood.
I was just fascinated with these people. They were the characters, really, that represented different possibilities, different worlds. You know, George Michael and Andrew Ridgeley's haircut. I loved them and their friendship. I was quite a lonely kid, so maybe that was that.
We'll also leaf through the day's papers and catch up on the news from last night's Met Gala in New York. That is ahead on The Globalist, live from London. First, a look at what else is happening in the news. A leaked report suggests that the US Supreme Court may be about to overturn the nation's legal right to abortion. European Union member states are divided as to how soon they can reduce their dependence on Russian energy supplies. And in Ukraine, attacks have resumed on the Mariupol steelworks, in which hundreds of civilians remain trapped inside. Stay tuned to Monocle 24 throughout the day for more on those stories. But first, a senior US diplomat says Washington has credible intelligence that Russia will try to annex Ukraine's Luhansk and Donetsk regions sometime in mid-May. US and Western officials also believe Moscow could formally declare war on Ukraine on the 9th of May, when Russia celebrates Victory Day. Natalia Vasilieva is the Telegraph's Russia correspondent, currently based in Istanbul, and she joins me now. Welcome to the program. Natalia, all these reports from Washington suggest that the conflict will only intensify. How is the war, or special operation, as the Kremlin wants to call it, being discussed and reported in Russia?
Good morning. Yes, obviously two good points you made about possibly Russia possibly annexing Lugansk and Russia possibly declaring a formal war on Ukraine. Obviously, both of them show that the war is definitely dragging on. It's going much slower and at a much slower pace than expected. So both of those two moves would be quite logical, given the fact that it's quite obvious that the Kremlin never expected to be bogged down in Ukraine for over 2 months now. As you may know, President Putin signed a law about 2 months ago, which can be essentially described as a war censorship law that bars anyone from describing it as a war, because the whole purpose of the so-called special military operation, as they call it, was a fast and a decisive victory, which the Kremlin hasn't achieved yet. So obviously, declaring a war would be quite a big step, but it would be in line with what we're seeing, is the fact that obviously people are getting quite tired of what's happening, and there's little explanation on state media why Russia hasn't won yet.
Do you think people still believe that what is happening in Ukraine is indeed just a special operation, not an all-out war?
Well, television viewers most certainly, because millions of Russians have been exposed to state propaganda for years. What we're seeing on Russian television right now is building on years of lies and misinformation when Russians were told about, you know, Nazis in Ukraine. And we're actually seeing, you know, reports that we heard from the first days of the war clearly showed that a lot of those soldiers who were entering Ukraine, they were just as convinced that they were, quote, liberating Ukrainians, just like as any Russian television viewer.
Do you think there's a chance that when those soldiers at some point come back from Ukraine to Russia, they will tell their closest ones, their families and friends, what the situation actually was like in Ukraine?
Yes and no, because obviously we have heard stories of soldiers who went to Ukraine and they saw with their own eyes that the situation on the ground is quite different from what they were told. But also we saw, as you know, widespread reports of horrific violence, torture and war crimes. And obviously those people were very confused about what happened, and they were quite angered by the fact that they were not greeted as liberators. And I doubt that people who perpetrated war crimes will come back to Russia and say, well, you know, we actually did the wrong thing, at least not not right now, not in the short term, historically speaking. Mm.
As we briefly discussed already, US and Western officials do believe that Moscow could formally declare war on Ukraine on the 9th of May when Russia celebrates Victory Day. You said earlier that this would make sense, or it would have certain logic to it. What would that mean in practice?
Well, in practice, that would mean that Russia could declare martial law. It could announce the mass mobilization, which is something that the Kremlin has been anxious not to do. As we may remember, Putin, in his first televised speech at the start of the war, made it very clear. The speech was on Women's Day. He made it very clear that it's professionals who are fighting in Ukraine, that he has no intention of sending conscripts or anyone who didn't choose military as their job. But increasingly, we have seen that Russia's forces are depleted, and it's quite possible that if the war drags on much longer, the Kremlin will have to resort to mobilization. It would have to call in reservists. It might also have to introduce extraordinary measures in the economy. It may have to resort to things like shutting down the borders, which is something that martial law calls for.
Do you think Russians would ask any questions after that? How much appetite for actual war is there?
I mean, Russians have been asking questions for a long time, you know, for the past decade. We have seen waves of opposition protests. Obviously, there is this vocal minority, but also there is a fairly large majority of people who all they want, quite predictably, is to go on about living their own lives. So far, until the war started, unless you were politically active and unless you took an active stand against the Kremlin, you could be fine. No one was going to interfere into your daily life. Now, if a mass mobilization is indeed declared, if they call up reservists, if they, you know, call up men who done some military training 20 years ago, and if they suddenly ship to the front, this could be a real game changer. And this could definitely be politically fraught for the government. Mm.
Natalia, just looking at the latest developments, we don't have a clear picture of what the situation is like, for example, in the besieged Ukrainian port city of Mariupol. But reports do say that attacks have resumed on the city's steelworks, for example, despite hundreds of civilians remaining trapped inside. Can you tell us anything else about the situation in Mariupol?
A first group of evacuees was able to leave Mariupol on Sunday, I believe, and they reached the first major city in the Ukrainian government-controlled territory on Monday. Those evacuations are going much lower than expected. There were reports that about 100 people were able to leave the steelworks on Monday, but they were still in separatist-controlled territories. Shelling hasn't stopped, and obviously this makes the evacuations impossible. We may remember that the UN Secretary General was in Moscow last week, and he asked Putin to help organize the evacuations. And Putin insisted that there's no shelling in Mariupol, so people were free to go wherever they wanted. But that's obviously not true. And as of today, we're still speaking about several hundred civilians trapped into a maze of underground bunkers inside Azovstal, which is a really big steelworks. It's actually one of the biggest steel plants in Europe.
Do we have any better idea at the moment what Russia's plan is at the moment? What are its next goals?
Well, what we have been seeing in the past month is that obviously plan A, so to speak, never worked. Russia never achieved a lightning invasion. 2 months into the war, it only controls a fraction of eastern Ukraine. It has not seized any regional capitals except for Kherson near Crimea. About a week ago, they announced there that they will free focus on seizing eastern Ukraine, the full of all of the Donetsk and Luhansk regions. But even there, the offensive is going quite slower, especially because this is the area where which have been fortified for years by Ukrainian government troops, and retaking all of Donetsk and Luhansk is going to be a quite a tall order, as we see now, even if all of the Russian forces are concentrated now in the east of Ukraine.
Natalia, thank you very much for your insights. That was The Telegraph's Natalia Vasilieva, and you're listening to The Globalist on Monocle 24. It is 9:11, almost 12 a.m. in Helsinki, 8:12 a.m. in Stockholm, and 7:12 a.m. here in London. You are listening to The Globalist on Monocle 24. Russia's invasion of Ukraine has pushed Sweden and Finland to the verge of applying for NATO membership, abandoning their long-held stance of strict neutrality. As both countries look poised to join the military alliance, experts are expecting a rise in Russian cyberattacks and targeted disinformation campaigns. Joining me now from Helsinki is Hanna Smith, Director of Research and Analysis at the Center of Excellence for Countering Hybrid Threats. Welcome to the program, Hanna. First of all, it currently seems that the Kremlin's focus is very much in Ukraine. Do you think we have an idea yet of how Russia may react to the NATO membership applications by Helsinki and Stockholm?
Well, the thing is that Russia has threatened us all the time, both Finland and Sweden, with the political and military consequences in case we are going to seek membership and become members of NATO. So far, those threats have been mostly in the diplomatic circles. It looks like that the Russian press has started to prepare this narrative that Finland is enemy of Russia, and that we have seen a little bit of more cyber activity information possibly than before. But I think this got a little bit of surprise for also Moscow that things have moved so fast in both Finland and Sweden.
So you say that the Russian enemy is gradually beginning to suggest that Finland is an enemy. How do they explain that? Do they talk about fascists of Finland, for example? I'm referring to what was used as an excuse to attack Ukraine, for example, denazification.
The interesting thing is that, yes, this is the amazing thing about history. It seems so that authoritarian regimes can always find excuses from the past. And in this case, in the case of Finland, they have found this thing that, or their narrative is that Finland was a close ally of the Nazi Germany in the Second World War, and some of the kind of military, I suppose, crimes in some ways during the Second World War that happened in Karelia is as a proof that Finns are fascist, and this has been sleeping in our identity for this long, and now It has surfaced again, and this is the fascists in Finland that are pushing Finland to become a member in NATO.
Can Russian media offer any evidence of that?
Of course not. So this is how history is kind of reinterpreted or interpreted the way how a political regime wants to. So the truth is that obviously Finland was not an ally, but cooperated with Germany. And as in all wars, horrible things happen, and both sides are kind of responsible for that. So these kind of things, yes. But to push it that far, as the Russian press is doing it now, is a false interpretation of history.
Quite a stretch, indeed. How can a country like Finland fight back when it comes to this kind of misinformation?
Well, I suppose we are lucky in that way that this is not a new situation in historical terms. The pressure from our eastern neighbor has been constant, sometimes less, sometimes more. So there is that kind of a knowledge anyway in Finland that we need to resist this. But that's a kind of a starting point. When there is a situational awareness which is correct, then that helps a lot. But still, obviously, it makes us a little bit kind of worried. The general feeling is that we can manage this.
But what does that mean in practice? What can Finland do in practice? What can Finnish decision makers do, or say Finnish embassies abroad?
Well, obviously the situational awareness is the key word here, in the way that to actually be as transparent as possible when things are happening, show when there is a kind of information aspect, to try to be actually a little bit ahead of that curve and try to find those aspects that we can expect from Russian side. Obviously, the cyber defenses needs to be kind of in alert. The Finnish army has actually raised alertness just to make sure that no surprises is going to happen. The active diplomatic kind of networking discussions, etc., is going on. So you need to be working hard in kind of all areas, and specifically this transparency and preparedness are perhaps the keys here.
At the moment, it seems pretty clear that both Finland and Sweden are indeed going to apply for NATO membership. How nasty could the situation with Russia get?
Well, we are still kind of hoping that this situation now, the war in Ukraine, the internal situation in Russia, which is also quite worrying, and at the same time, Russia kind of fighting against the sanctions, that those three things are affecting the fact that Russia cannot put its full attention to us. And therefore, we're hoping that it's not going to get too bad. Perhaps the worst things are coming later, even then when we are members of NATO, in the way that this kind of hybrid threat activity, as in our center we're talking about, which is below the threshold of war, can still get quite nasty. So right now, Russia might not have the capabilities to become very, very nasty, but in the future, that's very possible.
What kind of scenarios is Finland, for example, getting prepared for at the moment?
So it is this massive cyber attack, which might kind of even result of loss of life, like attacking hospitals, which actually we've seen in Germany happening prior, not this year, but in the previous times. Or then the kind of worst case scenarios that they do GPS disturbance or something like that relating to the maritime traffic. Logistical change so that a big boat goes on the ground, or things like that, which are kind of in our category a massive disaster, so to speak, but not yet declaration of war.
What do you think are the best lessons Finland and Sweden could learn from, say, the Baltic nations that have been NATO members for quite some time already and are Russia's neighbors?
Well, it is clear that NATO membership puts the threshold for any military invasion or even attack very, very high. So this is definitely the one that we have seen. And also, it seems so that NATO membership has brought a certain stability for Baltic states and a freedom of movement, so to speak, the sovereign decision. So you don't need to be afraid the same way, kind of, a Russian pressure. The situation in Finland and Sweden has been obviously different than in the Baltic states in historical terms as well. But I think this is definitely, if looking at towards Russia, the fear of military invasion or war will be less.
What is interesting is that you mentioned earlier that when it comes to the threat of Russian cyber war, for example, or disturbance, it doesn't end when Finland, for example, joins NATO. Instead, it's going to be a more permanent thing that's going to last. Does that mean that Finland and Sweden will have to come up with something more permanent also when they are trying to counteract? Do you think Finnish government, for example, will need to redirect some resources to simply spend more money and spend more human resources to fight Russian misinformation?
I actually think that this is, whether we are a member of NATO or not, this is the case. And when you asked, in fact, about this lessons relating to the Baltic states, that's one of them. Those are members of a NATO, and they have been under quite a substantial cyber threat activity, whether it comes to disinformation or cyber or other disturbance, diplomatic pressures or logistical disturbances and so on. So this is the lesson learned. NATO membership does not fully deter cyber threat activity, and therefore in the future, not only Finland, but I think all the EU and NATO members need to be prepared for this type of an activity.
Hanna, you are in Helsinki and you are obviously following news there. Is there any doubt that Finland is going to join NATO soon?
The general feeling here is that this is it. We are going to make the historical decision now and finally seal the Finland's place in fully in the Western community. And break the historical ties towards Russia. So that's the general feeling, and I actually believe that this is the direction it's going to go now.
Hanna Smith, thank you very much for joining us. It's 7:22 here in London. You are with The Globalist. Still to come in the program, we hear why the Biden administration is trying to ramp up its diplomatic ties with the Pacific Islands. And Alessio Batalano joins me in the studio to leaf through the day's newspapers. Stay tuned.
UBS has over 900 investment analysts from over 100 different countries.
Over 900 of the sharpest minds and freshest thinkers in the world of finance today.
To find out how we could help you,
contact us at ubs.com.
We turn next to the Pacific Islands, a region that has in recent years become the center of a geopolitical tug of war between China and the United States. As anxieties over China's military presence in the Solomon Islands mount, the Biden administration has pledged to ramp up its diplomatic ties with the region. Joining me now from Auckland is Fiona Ai, an independent legal analyst and partner of Clark I Korea Lawyers. Fiona is usually based in Apia, Samoa, where she has lived for 20 years. Welcome to the program. Could you first tell us, Fiona, what exactly is happening now? How is the United States stepping up its diplomatic ties with the Pacific region?
Well, Marcus, we're seeing a renewed interest in our part of the world that's only come about really in the last year or so since Solomon Islands switched its allegiance diplomatically from Taiwan to China, and we're seeing a significant ramp up of the Chinese diplomatic presence in the region.
Why does America see the region so valuable strategically?
Well, I think for a long time they haven't, except during World War II, of course. There are some areas of strategic interest to the US with their territories in the Northern Pacific, particularly Guam, and they have the territory of American Samoa. And I think that for a long time that's been considered enough. But now, as all of these independent South Pacific islands are having a much deeper engagement with China. It's caught a number of countries in the West unawares.
So what is happening in practice now? How is this US charm offensive working in practice?
Well, at the moment, we haven't really seen any significant changes, really. We've had an indication that there's going to be a greater engagement and some new missions opened and increased personnel and aid support, but nothing has actually come through on the ground.
That remains to be seen, that is. What do you think will be on the Pacific Island countries' leaders' agendas when it comes to dealing with the United States? What would they like to gain from all this?
I think that probably two things. One is increased aid, as a lot of developing countries and some least developed countries, the Pacific is always looking for help in that area of aid and development assistance. But I think more significantly is the issue of climate change, that when the West looks at the Pacific in terms of security issues, they see it in terms of the military. When Pacific Islands think about security issues, it's the existential threat of climate change. And without any real significant understanding or commitments on climate change from countries like the US and Australia, that is going to remain a disconnect.
Let's talk about your home country, Samoa. How is Samoa balancing its relations with China and the US?
It's been an interesting last couple of years with the pandemic, because the borders have been closed for the last 2 years. The usual high level of Chinese presence with a lot of infrastructure projects and workers has dropped off. We've also had less foreign workers coming in for development projects because of all those border restrictions. But we have seen, since the government changed last year, one of the first things that the new government committed to was to halt a controversial port project that the Chinese government was going to fund. And I think that has caused a bit of a reset in the relations between Samoa and China. But we haven't yet seen any deeper engagement between the US and Samoa.
What was the official explanation for scrapping that port project?
That it had no proper socioeconomic benefit. The cost-benefit analysis just didn't play out. That a country that already has a main deep water port, to build another port in a what's basically a mangrove area, and that would require constant dredging, had no cost-benefit that would play out in any proper way, and it would put Samoa into enormous debt. Would have doubled our foreign debt with no conceivable benefit.
How do the locals feel about what is happening at the moment? Do they have opinions about American or Chinese involvement in Samoa?
There are long-term ties between Samoa and China. There have been Chinese workers in Samoa since the 19th century, and a lot of Samoan families have Chinese surnames and Chinese family histories. The Chinese embassy has been in Samoa since the early 1970s. They were one of the first countries to recognize Samoa as an independent state. The American presence, on the other hand, has also been long-term, with lots of people-to-people links, but less of the diplomatic engagement. And we've seen that drop off over the last several decades.
How common discussion topic is that over there? How often is that discussed at dinner parties?
It's more of the Chinese relationship that's discussed, because there's been a lot of controversy about the increased reliance on Chinese aid, projects that have been less than transparent, because it's not clear whether the infrastructure's been funded as a grant or it's a loan. There's a lot of projects that have been portrayed as being assistance or a gift, and in fact it's a loan that has saddled the country with significant amounts of debts. The American issue not such a big issue because it's just, on the ground, it's just not really being seen.
Fiona, thank you very much for joining us here on Monocle 24 today. That was the legal analyst Fiona Ai joining us from Auckland. And now here is what else we're keeping an eye on today. A leaked document suggests that the US Supreme Court may be about to overturn the nation's legal right to abortion. Politico reports that Justice Samuel Alito wrote that the landmark 1973 Roe v. Wade decision is egregiously wrong. European Union member states remain divided as to how soon they can reduce their dependence on Russian energy supplies. EU ministers met yesterday to discuss how to manage the situation under pressure to reduce the revenue stream supporting President Putin's war in Ukraine. And according to reports, attacks have resumed on the Mariupol steelworks in which hundreds of civilians remain trapped inside. Some of the civilians have spent numerous weeks sheltering in the Azovstal steelworks, where food, water and medicine supplies are all running low. This is The Globalist. Stay tuned. Earlier on the show, we were discussing the rise of disinformation, which is a sobering reminder of the essential need for factual reporting, especially in the face of authoritarianism. Well, today is World Press Freedom Day, and for more on the current climate of press freedom, I'm joined by Rebecca Vincent, Director of Operations and Campaigns at Reporters Without Borders. Good morning, Rebecca.
Good morning, Marcus.
Shall we start by talking about what kind of a year for press freedoms this year has been so far?
Unfortunately, we're looking at another situation of global deterioration, which is often the case year to year. But this year, we've particularly highlighted a new era of polarization. So we're talking about polarization within countries and polarization between countries. Even in some of the most democratic states, those we think of as standard setters when it comes to press freedom, we've seen this rise of really the opinion news, like Fox newsization model that has taken hold is resulting in polarization even within democracies. And then between more open societies and more authoritarian regimes, we're seeing a widening rift as well, particularly with authoritarian regimes now not only working to control the flow of information within their own borders, but waging propaganda wars against democracies themselves. This has been very evident in particular with the Russian invasion of Ukraine, which was, of course, preceded by an information war before any physical conflict took place.
How recent developments are these?
So in terms of some of the situations in the countries that we've highlighted have been deteriorating for years, but we've seen a very rapid acceleration in some. Unfortunately, we now have a very bad country situation. That's the worst category. If you look at the rankings and the map that accompanies our index, a record number of very bad rankings in 28 countries this year. We have seen some very dramatic movements in a few places. I want to highlight Hong Kong in particular and Myanmar. So Hong Kong, of course, has instituted a crackdown on the free press following the adoption of draconian national security legislation under China's control about a year ago. And we've seen widespread targeting of independent media and imprisonment of journalists, including Jimmy Lai, for example. Hong Kong seems now determined to follow China right down to the bottom of the index. Myanmar now has 60 journalists in prison. I think a situation that many people in the world are not aware of. We sort of know that China has many journalists jailed, but Myanmar is now the second biggest jailer of journalists and has now joined the club of countries at the very bottom of the index. So year to year, we've seen the same few states jostling for that last spot, and now Myanmar is among them. So the bottom five this year would be Myanmar, Turkmenistan, Iran, Eritrea, and then North Korea.
What are the biggest issues in Western countries with free media, such as the US, UK, or Australia?
So polarization has played a big role in the scorings that we've seen in some of the more democratic states. Also, you know, we've seen sort of a continuation of a longer term trend of violations of press freedom that are sort of collateral damage of national security policies in a way. I should mention as well that we've updated our methodology this year. So I would caution, like, care is needed in comparing the exact ranking year to year. We now have a sort of more robust and modernized methodology centered on five indicators, which include the political context, economic situation, legal context, social, cultural context, and then the security situation in each country. So that's resulted in some changes in scoring in some of our democracies where the situation hasn't actually improved, the UK among them. So in the UK, for example, we've highlighted concern about the continued detention of WikiLeaks publisher Julian Assange, as the UK government seems set it's paved the way for his possible extradition to the United States. In the United States, really, this polarization has played a big role, but there's also been a number of concerning press freedom violations there that didn't end, unfortunately, with the Trump era. So we feel very strongly that it's necessary to hold our democracies to account as well, to ensure that our standard setters are just doing that and not sort of encouraging a race to the bottom when it comes to press freedom performance.
Absolutely. Rebecca, you haven't given us good news yet, but can you find some positive developments from this report as well? Are there any places where the situation has actually got better?
Yes, there are. And I'm glad that you asked, because it does seem like a very negative story when we set out. But there's always success stories in each year's index. These are often states where there's been some sort of political change, sometimes a change in government or just really an indication of political will to address the situation. So this year we've seen serious improvements in Moldova and Bulgaria. So I'd highlight those. And then, of course, there's always countries at the top of the index that consistently just perform well. So once again, it's a trio of Nordic countries at the very top of this year's index. That's Norway, Denmark, and Sweden. And just to note that Estonia and Lithuania have also entered the club of the sort of top 10 countries when it comes to press freedom. And I'd note that not only because of their domestic performance, but both of those are states that have played an important role, an increasingly important role in championing media freedom at the global level.
That's very good to hear. Rebecca, what do you think is the best recipe for trying to improve the situation globally? Or is it more about individual countries and the struggles the media is going through in them?
I'd say it's very globally linked. And so no country can approach this in a silo, although, of course, our states, including our own democracies, must ensure that, you know, we're doing what we say in terms of media freedom, that it's not just something that we're preaching abroad. So each state does need to ensure that it's meeting its own obligations. But the nature of freedom of information is interconnected. And so this is very much a global issue. We've seen that for a number of years now with China in particular. China has long held one of the world's worst press freedom records, but in recent years, it's worked to sort of spread that model of information control throughout the region and internationally. And now we're seeing it in a more heightened way this year with Russia. I think the world is very now well aware now of the disinformation and propaganda campaigns that have been waged there, which impacts our global information system. So I say a bit of both. We hold ourselves to account. We can't become complacent anywhere. That's another finding, sort of that holds true. More true each year, I would say, but we also have to work together to address this as a global issue.
Absolutely. Rebecca Vincent from Reporters Without Borders, thank you so much for joining us today. It's 7:37 a.m. here in London. You are with The Globalist. It is almost certain that you can think of songs or pieces of music which have an extraordinarily potent effect on your mood. You might not have thought much about why, but the music journalist Jude Rogers has. Her new book, The Sound of Being Human, How Music Shapes Our Lives, is both a memoir of her own journey as a pop fan and exploration of the psychological and neurological reasons why music has the extraordinary effect on us that it does. Monocle's Andrew Miller spoke to Jude Rogers earlier at Midori House. He began by asking her if she thinks pop music and the love for it reflects our psychological needs.
Yeah, it is a search for something that will fill a gap in many ways. I think it's just a place of possibilities, really. It's a place of different experiences, different people. You know, where I grew up was, you know, everywhere. Everyone thinks they grew up somewhere deeply ordinary and boring. But, you know, I grew up in a South Walian family, you know, lower middle class, you know, grandparents, you know, down the road, quite old-fashioned in some respects in Wales. So suddenly pop music entering this, you know, rainy South Walian enclave was quite an amazing thing. And yes, when my father died, you know, the first memories I had after his death in my head now, and this is interesting as well, because memory is something I go into in detail in the book, and it's fragility and, you know, how songs help us pin down memories. It was a link to my dad. The kind of songs were a link to my father. And, you know, I know from his friends and family that he was a lover of music. He left behind his records, obviously. And music was the fact that the last thing I remember of our time together was me and him talking on the front doorstep about him telling me to remember what was going to be number one that week, because he was going into hospital and he couldn't find out. And, you know, that was, when I go back to my last memory of him, it's him asking me that question. I know at that age I loved music already. And obviously I went on to become a music journalist. So there you go.
Well, this obviously is a similar trajectory to the one I described up to a point as well, in that I developed, for some reason I never fully comprehended, some obviously untoward fondness for popular music, which led me to wanting to write about it. But what I marvelled about at your book, and it was something I don't think I could bring myself to do at all, possibly due to overt self-consciousness, but that brilliant, absolutely unself-conscious capturing of the absolute unrestrained gaucheness of early pop fandom, when you're cutting things out and putting them in scrapbooks and earnestly poring over song lyrics trying to discern hidden meanings and stuff. You write about that younger version of yourself with great affection, which probably partially answers my question, but how excruciating or otherwise was writing those passages?
It wasn't excruciating at all, actually. I really enjoyed it. It's funny, when I, a little while before I started writing the book, I found lots of old stuff. My mum found a box of old exercise books from school and stuff like that. And there's actually a Nena Cherry sticker that is the start of one of the chapter headings now that comes from that time. No, I think it's because I partly still have it now. You know, I'm 43 years old and I still get incredibly moved by pop songs. I also have a seven-year-old who is now in that stage, and he is obsessed with Ed Sheeran's Bad Habits. And, you know, he doesn't understand what the words are. He doesn't understand the words of songs. And I don't think I did at that time either. I was just fascinated with these people. They were characters, really, that represented different possibilities, different worlds, different things that I could learn about. You know, the people for me, you know, I write about some of them in the book. You know, there is, you know, George Michael and Andrew Ridgeley's haircuts. What were these haircuts? And these, you know, these amazing coiffured Princess Diana kind of things. I loved them and their friendship, and this idealised version of friendship. I was quite a lonely kid, so maybe that was that. Nena Cherry came along singing Buffalo Stance on Top of the Pops. And she was this, you know, she was like anybody I knew. She was a woman from, she was Swedish, but she'd grown up in America. She was mixed race. She had an African dad. She was pregnant, Top of the Pops. She was rapping. You know, I was a little, you know, Welsh girl who went to Sunday school. Adamant is another one who, you know, I kind of just saw him like this fairy tale hero figure. And I think, you know, we still carry these people with us even when we're grown up. We might feel a bit embarrassed about it. Well, some people might. I don't think I do, actually. I think I'm quite at peace with it.
did you not ever find, especially once you became established as a music journalist, that actually getting to know these people took away any of that mystique? There is a bit where you mention going to see Tony Bennett, and at the party afterwards you see somebody vaguely familiar who appears to have arrived with a former colleague of mine, in fact, Simon Price from Melody Maker, and you recognise, spoiler alert, that it is, in fact, Adamant. Do moments like that take anything away from this for you, when you just realise, oh, it's just that it's that guy in a hat and we're in a room?
Well, that was at the end of the night when I'd had a few glasses of wine at the after party and I ran up the stairs and called my mum excitedly. My mum was just like, why, you know, I knew in the back of her head, it's like, why are you calling me? You know, it's 10:45, I'm in bed, you're 30.
Yeah, who's died?
Yeah, exactly, exactly. I did run away that night, and I've never seen him live since. I've never interviewed him. I don't think I want to, because that moment was so magical, just chancing upon him. So, yeah, I guess it does affect things. You know, I write a chapter about my teenage obsession with REM and what it was like to interview Michael Stipe years later. And I really wanted to write about that because I don't think music journalists write a lot about, you know, the fact that, you know, we want to interview people because we're fans, and it's a very hard dynamic to kind of navigate when you're trying to be this, you know, objective, critical, you know, good journalist. And I try and kind of investigate that a little bit. But, you know, I didn't sleep the night before I interviewed Michael Stipe because I was that 14-year-old girl still, you know. And also I just didn't want him to hate the interview, partly for professional reasons, but mainly for personal ones.
Jude Rogers in conversation with Monocle's Andrew Müller there. You are listening to Monocle 24. We continue with fashion news after this quick break.
UBS is a global financial services firm with over 150 years of heritage. Built on the unique dedication of our people, we bring fresh thinking and perspective to our work. We know that it takes a marriage of intelligence and heart to create lasting value for our clients. It's about having the right ideas, of course, but also about having one of the most accomplished systems and an unrivaled network of global experts. That's why at UBS, we pride ourselves on thinking smarter to make a real difference. Tune in to The Bulletin with UBS every week for the latest insights and opinions from UBS all around the world.
Welcome back. You're listening to The Globalist on Monocle 24. I am Markus Hippi. Fashion's biggest event of the year, the Met Gala, took place last night in New York. Joining me to unpack this year's fashion spectacle is the retail expert and brand consultant Rebecca Tay. Rebecca, good morning to you.
Hi, Markus. Nice to see you.
Likewise. Shall we start with some criticism this year's Met Gala has received? I think that happens every year, doesn't it?
Yeah, the criticism does range. I think this year's was a little bit more, you know, poignant in terms of kind of economics and the current political climate. So the theme was gilded glamour and white tie. And I think the criticism was really around, you know, is now the time to really be talking about glamour? You know, it's the U.S. is kind of going into high levels of inflation. There's obviously the ongoing Russian invasion of Ukraine. So it's sort of, there was one tweet, I think, that kind of went a little bit viral that said, gilded glamour at a time of war, basically let them eat cake. So it's obviously a reference to Marie Antoinette and that kind of idea that, you know, it's sort of the high and mighty that are able to talk about glamour and dresses while the rest of the world is, you know, facing a little bit more of a harsher reality.
Well, the theme was gilded glamour and white tie, as you mentioned. How did the guests translate that theme?
It was quite interesting. So technically, the exhibition was actually supposed to be focusing on 1870 to 1890. This is the era that they were talking about in terms of this gilded glamour. But it really kind of came out in a whole range of ways. So I think the standout look for the evening was Kim Kardashian and Marilyn Monroe. So she was wearing an old dress by Marilyn Monroe. It was the first time it has seen the light of day since she wore it to sing happy birthday to JFK. So there's a sort of glamorous moment in the sense that it's Marilyn Monroe. Obviously, Kim Kardashian also dyed her hair blonde to go along with that. And then I think gilded, a lot of people took that quite literally. There was a lot of gold on the red carpet. The British model Cara Delevingne actually showed up partly painted in gold alongside kind of a red tuxedo look. But there are a lot of red, a lot of gold kind of armor, lots of gold jewelry, lots of gold kind of dresses and gowns altogether.
And what did Anna Wintour wear? That was something that's been reported.
Yeah, so Anna Wintour, you know, obviously she's known for her signature bob haircut and her sunglasses. She doesn't normally wear sunglasses on the red carpet for the Met Gala, but last night she did actually wear a tiara. So that was quite an interesting look, I think, for her. You know, does that speak to gilded glamour? Who knows? But I think people like the fact that she wore something a bit different.
Shall we talk about any surprising or shock moments from last night? What will this year's event be remembered for?
Yeah, I think... Interestingly, I think Hillary Clinton made a surprise appearance. You know, people aren't actually talking about it that much, but I think, you know, it wasn't actually planned. It was a cameo, I think, that she made at the last minute. There was also an engagement on the steps, which is quite a nice, you know, a very grand way to propose. And it was to the New York commissioner. She's related to the sort of planning of the event. I believe she said yes. I'd have to confirm that. But that was, you know, it's not one of the fashion moments, but definitely one of the more surprising kind of interesting moments to sort of touch on, I think.
Do you think it has made a difference that the organizers of Met Gala have asked their guests not to take selfies and not to be on social media?
You know, I think it's potentially. I think there's so much around social media anyway. It really floods all of our news channels and our emails. I think I received about 15 emails already this morning just about all the best looks. And I was receiving about the same number of emails kind of in the 5 minutes before the Met Gala actually started. So I don't think it necessarily changes the sort of furor that is kind of, you know, out there when the Met Gala begins. But it does change, I think, the dynamic on the red carpet itself. So obviously everyone is very much focused on the press, posing, you know, doing their kind of entry, their grand entrance up those, you know, amazing iconic steps of the Met Gala, of the Met. So I think it has probably changed in that sense. There's a little bit less of those selfie moments. But when you look at the videos of what's happening, you can hear all the fans screaming. I think there's so much that happens with the lead up, and Vogue does cover it extensively now. So I don't think there's any sort of dearth of footage of the event, even though social media is no longer as big a part from everybody else.
That was the retail expert and brand consultant, Rebecca Tay. Thank you so much for joining us here on Monocle 24. It is 15:50 in Tokyo, 8:50 a.m. in Zurich, and 7:50 a.m. here in London. You are with Monocle 24. Let's continue now with today's newspapers. Joining me in the studio is Alessio Patana, professor at King's College London. Good morning. Good to see you here.
Marcus, good morning.
I see that you already have the Financial Times in front of you. What have you spotted from there?
So this is one of the big debates of today, really. We all know that after the initial reluctance, then the German government seemed to be coming ahead of the Ukrainian problem, and then again they slowed the process down, and really it's sort of an act with different steps. And first there was the support to the capacity of Ukraine to militarily resist Russia. Then it became a question of how do we not support Russia indirectly because of all the dependency that we have. So today we have the new sort of element adding to the story about Europe economic dependency, because Germany is supporting the FT, is prepared to back the oil embargo. Now, this is an important story for a number of different reasons. But I think the three things that for us to sort of kick off the conversation to think about are, one, the fact that Germany is giving their nodding, but at the same time they're saying we need to be very careful because not everybody is in the same sort of place. Two, if we're too quick, we need to be prepared for hit, an economic hit that will come back to Europe in terms of energy prices, although arguably we kind of knew that already. And three, you see a split within Europe because of how different countries may or may not be in a position to deal with the consequences of this oil embargo.
So the headline of this article is that Germany wants EU to expect economic cost from Russian oil embargo. I was kind of wondering, isn't this something the European countries probably knew already?
No, I think you're absolutely right. I mean, particularly, you know, countries like among the major countries, one very interesting case that is briefly mentioned is Italy, that realised very early on that it had a considerable dependency and started to make all sorts of moves. And now Draghi, of course, being an economist, has started to talk about putting tariffs on imports to allow for some of the European countries that still have problems in that sort of replacing energy coming from Russia with something else to buy them a little bit more time. But it seems to me that what is really interesting is the fact that I think this is very much sort of the German government seeing what's likely to happen in Germany and trying to make it a European problem, as it were.
Let's continue with this day's edition of The Guardian. Boris Johnson, British Prime Minister, is expected to deliver a virtual address to the Ukrainian Parliament today.
And Marcus, there's a nice link there, because domestic politics, so the war in Ukraine is becoming an inherent part of the fabric of our domestic political debates, whether you're in Germany, where it's still a coalition government that is putting things together, or you're in the UK, where the Prime Minister is constantly sort of challenged for his leadership, but at the same time, is also the, you know, the first major European leader to walk across the streets of Kiev, and now is going to be the first leader worldwide to address the Ukrainian Parliament. So as you can see, that
it seems that he's more popular in Ukraine at the moment than in the UK.
Apparently so. I mean, and not without reason, because the UK has been, even before the war, sort of the invasion started, a very close supporter, if you want, of the Ukrainian capacity to push back against Russia. So there is an element there that tells us about his popularity in Ukraine, as you say, but also that he's well-funded, and it speaks to that sort of broader international profile. However, on a week during which there are questions raised about his chancellor's sort of financial links also to Russia, you cannot but wonder the extent to which all of this is also done in a way that it will support what is otherwise a rather fractured public image in this country of the Prime Minister.
Do you think Boris Johnson will have something new or surprising to say today?
Yes, indeed. The most important being the new announcement of 300 million in additional military support to Ukraine, which again sets the UK in a rather sort of like a very clear context, even compared to the rest of Europe. So this is likely to remain one very important element of the story.
Let's continue then with something from Asia. From Japan to Indonesia, Asia weighs 4-day work weeks. That is from Nikkei, this article.
So, I mean, the Nikkei article actually is talking about Japan. It starts in Japan, but it's a phenomenon that has started to sort of a question that has been asked across the region. And that is very interesting. I mean, I'm sure you're very familiar with having sort of any travel to Asia, you'll realize that there's always a buzz of people going to work every day. And so the big debate now is now, this is not leading to higher productivity. There's statistical data to tell us this. The pandemic created the conditions to having to rethink about work. So the question is, can we switch to a 4-day week for work rather than a 5-day base one? And how will that do? How will that sort of help addressing this question of a lack of productivity?
And do you think 4-day work week would be some kind of a solution?
So the interesting thing about the article in the UK, and then if you pair it with a couple of pieces in the Straits Times, there are all sorts of side issues in the sense that it's not as easy. The day that you don't spend at work, does it actually going to lead to greater productivity? And then it links also to where you are, how many days you spend in the office, cohesion and cohesiveness of the workforce. So I think there are all sorts of other questions that need to be addressed. But certainly, I think one should welcome the fact that there is this conversation going on, because it is a very important conversation. It is one of the economic engines of the world, and definitely if on the one hand that they are one of the economic engines in the world, but in terms of productivity they are far below the standards that you see in the United States or in Europe, then that is an important question to address.
Sticking to the theme of work life, the Straits Times, which big companies are allowing working from home?
It's not just about working from home, but it's like some companies, particularly the big sort of data servers, Spotify, they started to sort of allow their part of the personnel to actually work from anywhere in the world. So it's absolutely fascinating how at the moment you have Asian newspapers all focusing on this question: how can we increase productivity while living better? I mean, coming from Asia of all places, this is absolutely incredibly interesting.
Is that something you're thinking about here in London sometimes yourself as well, how you can improve your quality of life?
I think so. I think that if you're in London, where this conversation has been going on for a while, it's actually quite refreshing to see it taken from a different perspective. And definitely, we could do with enjoying more what London has to offer and sort of using that as a way to come back and be more motivated at work.
Alessio Patalano, thank you so much for joining us here at Midori House Studio One, and see you soon. And that's all for today's edition of The Globalist. Thanks to our producers, Charlie Filmacourt and Emma Searle, our researcher, Samson Borgo, and our studio manager Christy Evans. After the headlines, there is more music on the way, and The Briefing is live at midday London time. Tom Edwards will be hosting that program today, and this program, The Globalist, returns at the same time tomorrow at 7 a.m. London time. I am Markus Hippi. Thanks for tuning in.